Hi, and welcome to this lecture on animal migration and animal navigation. My name is Andrea Flack. I am a group leader at the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior in Radovce, Konstanz. I'm very happy to be here today and have this slot to talk about animal migration and animal navigation. My own work and research focuses on different aspects of long-distance bird migration. I explore, for example, how social interactions shape the migratory movements of white storks. But in the past, I have also explored more navigational systems. I have worked, for example, during my PhD on homing pigeons. There, I have explored or studied how individual and social features influence the ability of a pigeon to find home. So I have a long history of navigation and migration research, and I hope I can excite you a bit here today to talk about these long distance journeys and also to give you some insights into migration research. How do we address and explore these long distance journeys? My email address is on that slide. Feel free to contact me with any kind of questions that you might have. And I'm also happy to take the time slot for your questions to discuss ideas and answer any kind of question that you have. Thank you. Please enjoy the lecture. When we think of animal migrations, we are usually fascinated by the large distances that these tiny animals cover in short time periods. And we will talk about the behavioral adaptations that they need to be able to do this in a few minutes. But before that, I would like to point your attention to another feature of animal migration that is very impressive. And that feature is also very important to our global ecosystems. And that is the ubiquity of this phenomenon. That means how widespread migrations are across the animal kingdom. We find migratory behavior in all major animal groups. That means in mammals, fish, butterflies, amphibians, and of course in birds. And when we look at birds alone, we see that nearly 20% of all bird species are migratory. This may not sound too much, but it means that every autumn, more than 2 billion songbirds, just songbirds, migrate from Europe to sub-Saharan Africa. And the movements of these animals have a strong impact on global ecology because migrants transport nutrients, they transport energy, and they transport other organisms. That means migratory animals couple distant ecological communities across the globe. And by doing so, they provide a lot of very important ecosystem services. In addition to these ecosystem services, the journeys that these animals conduct are often very impressive navigational achievements. Let's, for example, look at this monarch butterfly here. These butterflies occur in the northern parts of the American continent. So they are spread between the east and the west coast of Canada and the northern parts of the US. And in autumn, all of these butterflies migrate south to spend the winter all together in a small forest in Mexico. So this butterfly that weighs maybe 0.5 gram migrates more than 3,000 kilometers to overwinter in Mexico. And in the next spring, they fly back north to find the place where they originated from. But interestingly, those butterflies that fly back north are not the same individuals that flew south. That means it takes 4 generations to complete one migratory circuit. And that means those individuals that need to find the forest in autumn have never been there before. In fact, their parents haven't been there, and neither have their grandparents. Their great grandparents were the ones who visited that forest last. And what are the mechanisms behind this incredible journey? We will find out in this lecture. Another great example of a navigational achievement is the journey of loggerhead turtles. These turtles hatch from an egg on some beach on an island. Then they leave the island to swim around the ocean seas for the next 15, 20 years. And during that time, these turtles cover large distances, so they don't stay in proximity of the island where they originated from, but they swim all over the ocean. And 15, 20 years later, the females manage to return to the very same beach where they were born to lay her own eggs. But sometimes these turtles do not exactly land on the same beach where they were born. Sometimes they end up on an island 20, 50 kilometers away from their own natal beach. So does that mean they got it wrong? Hopefully by the end of this lecture, you will know the answer to this question. But it's not just the navigational skills that are very impressive. Many migratory animals have also adapted their behavior and their physiology to deal with the extreme conditions that they are facing throughout their journey. Like, for example, these bar-headed geese on the picture. They fly at extreme altitudes across the Himalaya. They fly at altitudes of more than 5,000 meters above the sea level. These altitudes, the oxygen level is less than 10% compared to that what we experience at sea level. But they adapted their behavior to minimize their costs, and we will soon learn how they did that. But before talking about these behavioral adaptations and navigational strategies that animals use to complete their migration, let me first give you a definition of what animal migration actually is. There are various ways in which migration can be defined. The definition can depend upon which aspect of the migration it focuses on. Here I give you two definitions. The first one is that migration is a locomotory activity that is persistent, undistracted, and straightened out. This definition relates to the individual, and it describes a process. Animals move in a consistent, directed way, leaving their day-to-day habitat to reach a new habitat. The second definition describes the outcome of this locomotory activity. And it defines migration ecologically at the population level. Here, migration is a seasonal to and fro movement of populations between regions where conditions are either favorable or unfavorable. And these regions include the area where breeding occurs. Finally, migration can take a number of forms and has been described in different species in different ways. Here I give you, as a third point, a few examples. First, the seasonal migration of birds. I think we are all very much familiar with this. These are movements between wintering and reproduction areas that birds conduct several times during their lifetime. Then we have the altitudinal migrations between different terrestrial elevations. This can, for example, be ungulates like roe deer migrating up and down mountains to take advantage of higher forage availability at higher altitudes during summer. The third one is fish migrations from lakes to streams, or finally, the once-in-a-lifetime migration of eels from freshwater to their natal marine habitat where they spawn. Next question I would like to talk about is, why do animals migrate? Well, the simple answer is that the activity of life on Earth is strongly influenced by seasonal and daily cycles. And within these cycles, different environmental conditions like temperature, precipitation, food availability, or even the number of daylight hours change regularly. And when animals migrate, they track these seasonal changes in resources and habitat. And when they do that, they avoid food scarcity and they seek physiologically optimal climate conditions. It is also known that migration allows migrants to escape from infected habitats, and that causes over pathogen prevalence in migratory populations. Migratory animals can also have reproductive benefits because they avoid predations during the nest period simply by moving into regions with lower predator densities. And finally, when animals move to higher latitudes, they also experience longer days. And these longer days might allow them to increase their activity time. In a recent study, colleagues and I have compared the activity levels of migrants to see, for example, whether Arctic migrants are able to use these longer days by increasing their activity levels, or whether they have a maximum level of activity that they cannot surpass because, for example, they have to sleep during certain times of the day and cannot just increase their activity. To monitor the activity of migrants, we attach these little tracking devices to them. We usually attach these devices with a little harness to juvenile birds when they're still on the nest. And these devices are solar powered, so we don't have to charge them, and they transmit all the data that they collect through the mobile phone network. And that allows us to monitor the location and the behavior of these birds for their entire life and nearly in real time, because they also transmit everything through the mobile phone network. These devices do not just record the location of an individual, but also the activity. And the activity is measured with an accelerometer unit that measures the acceleration of an animal, and it does this along three different axes. So it measures the up and downward movement, the left and right, and the back and forth movement. And these three different axes can be summarized or summed up into a single value that informs us on the amount that an animal moves. So all movements of these animals, flying, foraging, or walking, are summarized in this one single value. And this value allows us to compare, for example, the magnitude of activity between different species. So here we have, for example, a rough-legged buzzard, which is a raptor that migrates every summer to the Arctic to breed there. Another species that we monitored were white-fronted geese, which is also an Arctic migrant that goes there to raise their offspring during summer. And because these devices stay on the birds for their entire life, we are able to monitor a complete migratory cycle or a complete year of these birds. And so we see that some birds experience in winter periods where day length is only 6 to 7 hours. But then in summer, when they go to the Arctic, they experience polar days. That means they experience continuous daylight. And you see that together with the length of the day, the birds manage to increase their activity levels. So the longer the days, the more active these birds can be. And that, of course, gives them an advantage compared to the birds that stay at lower latitudes, because they are less restricted by nighttime periods. They can forage during the day and care for their offspring during the day, which birds at lower latitudes cannot do simply because of the night. Next, I would like to talk about the requirements of migration. How does an animal need to be adapted and what does it need to be adapted to complete its migration successfully? Well, first, it needs to get the time right. That means it needs to have inherited an endogenous program for the sequence, the progress, and the expression of its migration stage. The phenology of migration, so the timing of migration, is usually determined by different endocrine processes. Different sets of hormones are involved in this process. This is mainly studied by physiologists, and this is also why I will not go into details about the whole field of migration phenology here. Another requirement is that animals need to adapt their physiology. Long-distance migrants have evolved specific adaptations to make their athletic journeys possible. These adaptations often involve the metabolism and the fuel deposition. This has been especially studied in birds by looking at their metabolic rate. So that is the amount of energy they spend per unit of time. The metabolic rate that birds maintain during migration is 10 to 15 times higher than that during resting. And to be able to achieve this, birds have different physiological adaptations. They can, for example, mobilize, transport, or oxidize lipids at much higher rate during migration. But again, this is a rather physiological process, and I won't go into details here now because I would like to spend more time on the behavioral adaptations that allow animals to respond to the variable environmental conditions and that allow migrants to minimize their movement costs by using the environment around them. Depending on the species, we see, of course, different behavioral adaptations that allows animals to minimize movement costs or to deal with extreme environmental conditions. I would like to start to talk about large bird species because here I can give you some examples coming from my own work. One typical adaptation, for example, of large birds to save energy is the so-called soaring gliding flight. Large birds like storks or raptors cannot migrate efficiently by flapping their wings. They are just too large and too heavy, and they cannot accumulate enough fat reserves to fuel long periods of flapping flight. Instead, they exploit the atmospheric conditions around them so that they can move without having to invest a lot of energy. And they can do this by using vertical air movements. And there are different types of vertical air movements that birds can use. The first ones are, for example, these thermal updrafts. These are localized columns of rising air, and they develop because the sun warms the Earth's surface during the day, and then the air starts to rise. And birds can use this warm rising air to gain altitude. And to do this, they circle in these columns of warm air. And once they reach the top of the thermal, which is usually just beneath the clouds, and then they start to glide forward towards the next thermal. And the direction in which they glide is usually their migratory direction. And during gliding, they do not have to flap their wings. When they glide, they lose altitude again. So it means it's important that they find another thermal. So in the end, to repeat the entire process. There's another vertical wind that is the orographic uplift. And this occurs because horizontal wind gets deflected by coral structures like, for example, mountains or waves. And again, birds can circle in this orographic uplift to gain altitude to then glide without having to flap their wings. All of these birds are very dependent on these vertical wind movements. And because these are usually restricted to landmarks, we see these typical flyways of these bird species that circumvent or that go around large water bodies, like the Mediterranean Sea, for example. Their flyways are shaped along topographic features that support the formation of thermals or orographic uplift, like mountain ranges, narrow valleys, or coastal plains. So birds, like, for example, storks, are adapted to save energy by using these thermal updrafts. And we can monitor the ability to do this by using the tracking devices that I've told you about before. We attach these devices to the juvenile storks when they're still in the nest to be able to follow them, their movements, and their activity throughout their entire lifetime. And in a recent study of mine, we did this not just with one bird, but with a flock, with a group of storks that was migrating together as a flock. So storks are not just adapted, or storks have not just adapted their behavior by using these thermal updrafts, but they also fly in social groups. This helps them to detect these thermals, to find these thermals, and to exploit these thermals. And when we monitor birds that fly together in these thermals as one flock in close proximity to each other, we are also able to detect inter-individual differences in their flight performance. And here again, we look at the accelerometer data. When we look at the vertical axis of this accelerometer recordings, we see very well whether a stork flaps its wings or not. And remember, storks are large, heavy birds. Flapping its wings means to spend much more energy. They try to avoid this as much as possible. And when we now have storks flying together in a flock, we can very clearly compare the flight performance of individuals that fly together under the same environmental conditions. And here in the bottom graph, you see two individuals, the accelerometer recordings of two individuals flying together. We have on the one hand S01, and a set of these three lines are the accelerometer recordings of S01. And below, you have another individual, S27, and its accelerometer recording. And you already see that S01 has a rather steady accelerometer recording. There are hardly any kind of flapping peaks. S27, on the other hand, has these short bursts of flapping flight. And this is the first migration day of both birds. They were flying in the same flock under the same environmental conditions in very close proximity to each other. And that means that this flock consists of individuals that differ in their flight performance. And that means to cover the same distance during the same time, some individuals have to perform considerably more flapping flight than others do. And we can explore these differences in flight behavior even more when we combine the information of the flapping behavior with the positional data that we also record. Remember, our devices not just record accelerometer data, but also the GPS data, so the position of an individual. And this is being recorded every second. And when we have individuals flying together in the same flock, we can really examine the structure of this flock and where, for example, each of these individuals is positioned, whether they have a preferred position, whether they're always found in one part of the flock or the other one. Here you see an animation of the kind of data that we collect. This is the typical circling flight that storks perform to gain altitude. And you see that each of these storks has a tail, and the tail corresponds to the flapping activity. So the measure that gives information about how many times the bird has to flap its wings. You see that some individuals are red and orange. Those are the ones that with a high flapping activity. Some other individuals are in blue and green with a low flapping activity. And when we, as a next step, looked at where each of these individuals is positioned within the flock, we see that those with the low flapping activity can be found mostly in frontal positions of the flock. So they are ahead of most of the other individuals. The birds in red and orange with the
high flapping activity, on the other hand, are more in the rear part of the flock. So they are behind everyone else. And we see that these individual differences and these typical positions of the stork within the flock are consistent across different migration days, and they occur although all of these birds have the same age. They are all juveniles, and they are flying under the same environmental conditions. And we can see even more when we look at the long-term data of this the devices. So not just the short migration period, but also where they end up. And there, here we have, we're looking at the entire migration route of these birds within the first 4 weeks. And we see again that there are differences between the birds. The birds with in red and orange, remember these are the ones with the high flapping activity, have a much shorter migration distance. They migrate to Spain, or to sometimes not even Spain, but also only to France. Birds in green and blue migrate further. Some of them cross the Strait of Gibraltar to the African continent. And then we have the birds in blue with a very low flapping activity, and they even cross the Sahara. So the migration distance of these birds also differs quite a lot, with some individuals reaching 4,000 kilometers of migratory distance, whereas others just have less than 1,000 kilometers. And save energy. White storks fly in these clustered flocks that seem rather unstructured to us. Here, the social benefits come from getting information on good flight conditions by observing others. They see where thermals occur, they see how strong a thermal is, and then they can move towards these areas based on the information coming from others. Other migratory species also use social interactions to minimize their movement costs. And the formation flight is a famous example of how flocking allows migrants to save energy. Here, birds obtain aerodynamic advantages from positioning themselves at a certain position in relation to its neighbor. And when they do this, the birds behind can benefit from the air movements that occur because of the flapping of the birds in front of it. When a bird flaps, it causes an updraft, and the birds in the back can benefit from this updraft. And a study that looked at this was conducted 20 years ago in France, and to quantify the cost and the benefits of this formation flight, they recorded the heart rates and the wing beat frequencies of pelicans flying in a formation. And this study showed that pelicans use 11 to 14% less energy when they were flying together in formation. Here on the figure, you see the heart rate recordings and the wing beat frequencies of these pelicans flying together. You see that when they glide, they don't flap their wings, and their heart rate is quite low. When they fly alone, they have high wing beats, and they also have high heart rate. And when they fly in formation, their heart rate is relatively low, and also their wing beat frequency is low. But this depends upon the position in which they are in. So the birds in the middle of this formation have much lower wing beat frequencies than, for example, the birds in front. And you see here that so the leader of this formation has higher wing beats and also higher heart rates of the birds in the middle. And you see here that there's a social dilemma coming from the question, who is going to fly in front and who is going to have the highest advantage? And if you think of this from an evolutionary perspective, you can ask yourself, okay, how can this kind of behavioral strategy evolve? Is this that all these birds have to be related to each other? Is these birds that they have to take turns? So each of them has to have share the costs and the benefits. And there are different ways in which different species deal with this dilemma. Another behavioral adaptation is that of the bar-headed geese. I have mentioned already in my introduction that these geese migrate across the Himalaya at extreme altitudes. And to understand how the geese do this, researchers also have attached tracking devices that record heart rates, wing beat frequencies, and the location. And they found that the geese do not just fly from one location in the Himalaya to the other, from one ridge to the next, but instead they kind of follow the profile of the mountains. They have this, what the study calls, roller coaster strategy that leads them up and down the mountain terrain. So they do not fly this straight path, but they go up and down the mountains. And the scientists have shown that when they compare this flight path, these two flight paths with each other, they see that this roller coaster strategy allows the geese to save energy. And this is because of the differences in air pressure and air densities. When they go up the mountains, they experience thinner air, and that makes the wing strokes less efficient. And so by staying at a low altitude, as low as possible, the geese save energy, because their wing beats are more efficient, and also the air that they breathe in contains more oxygen, and that is in the end efficient for them. Next, I would like to talk about behavioral adaptations of smaller birds, like, for example, passerines. Here it is much more challenging for us to discover these adaptations, or even to find out where these birds are going, because we cannot simply attach a GPS to these birds as we can with the storks. One of those storic GPS devices weighs approximately 40 grams. For a bird that weighs less than 15 grams, this is of course much more challenging. And here I would like to introduce you to another tracking technology that we use to track and locate small birds. This is a geolocator. It weighs approximately 1.5 grams, and it measures the light level of its surrounding. And with this light level measures, we can infer the sunrise and sunset of this location, and we can then estimate the location of the bird. In addition to a light level sensor, these devices also have an accelerometer. They measure barometric pressure to give information about the altitude at which the bird is flying, and they also measure temperature. And with this, it is, for example, possible to track these small birds, like this great reed warbler that you see in the photo here. But other than with the storks, it's also essential to recapture the bird, because these devices do not send the information, or it's not possible to download them, but you have to take off that the device to download the data. And also, of course, because these don't have solar panels, the batteries will become empty at some point. These great reed warblers here are nocturnal migrants. They migrate from the northern parts of Europe down to sub-Saharan Africa. When they do that, they cross the Mediterranean Sea, they cross the Sahara. And in a very recent study that was just published a few months ago in Science, scientists have discovered the way with which these birds manage to fly these large distances and are able to cross these difficult terrains like the sea or the desert. And they discovered that these birds actually do not fly at night all the time, but in fact, they extend their migration period throughout the day and also fly during the day. And to be able to do this, they do not just keep flying at their normal cruising altitude, which is approximately 2,400 meters above sea level, but they increase their flight altitude to more than 5,000 meters above sea level to be able to cover, for example, the desert or the Mediterranean. Because here at these altitudes, they have better flight temperatures. They do not overheat and have maybe also more favorable wind conditions. It's not entirely clear, but this flight altitude was not known before, and only by tracking the birds with these geolocators that also measure pressure and temperature, scientists were able to discover the adaptation of these birds to that allows them to cover these large distances in short time periods.
After talking about these behavioral adaptations for smaller and larger birds, I would like to go back to this slide that shows what successful migration requires. And the last point on this list is the control of orientation and navigation. So an animal needs to be able to detect where it is, and it needs to be able to detect where it wants to go and how to get there. To complete their long distance journeys, migratory animals have developed very different and often highly efficient navigational strategies to locate their destination. Different navigational cues, like the position of the sun, magnetic cues, or visual cues can be used for this. But these cues may be different when an animal is 1,000 kilometers away from its home, or just a few centimeters from the entrance of its nest. And this means that we can distinguish at least three different phases or stages in this long-distance migratory process, or in the process of this navigational task. And these three phases are the long distance phase, a homing phase that is much closer to home, and a pinpointing the goal phase, where it's just about finding, for example, the entrance. During the long distance phase, celestial or magnetic cues are very important, as well as maybe landmarks such as coastlines that can function as physical constraints and guiding animals towards a certain direction. During the homing phase, more regional cues like olfaction or visual landmarks can be used and may become more important. During the last phase, when it's just about pinpointing the entrance of a nest or the tree, visual landmarks, olfactory cues are possibly the most important ones. And this to understand these navigational processes and navigational strategies, scientists have performed many, many different studies on many, many different species, and there's just not a simple answer on how animals do this. And this also differs a lot between the different species.
In the second half of this lecture, I would like to give you an overview of the different navigational strategies that have been identified for different species and that animals use for different homing tasks. This is going to be a summary of migration or navigation research for the last 100 years. And I'm not going to only talk about the navigational cues that animals use, but sometimes also give you an idea of the experiments that have been performed to identify which navigational cues or strategies animals use. The first strategy is called piloting. That is in the last and final phase of the navigational task, when an animal tries to locate a certain tree and the entrance of its nest, the final goal. And to do this, animals usually use visual landmarks.
Now, our understanding of this navigational strategy comes from very early experiments of Nico Tinbergen. You probably have heard his name in one of the previous lectures. He's a Dutch biologist who is seen as the co-founder of the field of animal behavior. And in the 1920s, he performed beautiful experiments on this digger wasp here that in order to understand how they locate their nest entrance. Female digger wasps build their nest in small burrows in sandy ground, and the nest consists of four or five chambers branching off from a main tunnel. and the females lay an egg in each of these cells, and then the wasp flies out to hunt for bees, which she then brings back paralyzed to her nest so that her young can feed off these bees. Lindbergh observed that several females have their burrow in a small, tiny little area, and he wondered whether each wasp returned only to her own nest. And then he kind of performed one of the first tracking studies, because he marked each of these wasps with a colored drop of paint so that he was able to track these individuals. And by doing that, he found out that each wasp returned only to her own nest. And then he wondered, how do digger wasps locate their nest after returning from home? He hypothesized that they use landmarks to locate their burrow. And to test this hypothesis, he designed an experiment. He placed a circle of pine cones around the nest opening. Here you see the nest entrance, and here you see the circle of pine cones that he placed around it. And when the female leaves, you see that she performs this kind of flight around the nest, possibly to get her bearings. And then when the wasp had left, he shifted the circle of pine cones just to a location next to the nest where there is no nest entrance, and he observed what happened when the bee returned with her prey. And he observed that the bee actually searched in the location of the center of this pine cone circle. And with this, he concluded that the wasp used these visual cues to find the nest. And then at the moment when they leave the nest, they memorize the landmarks so that they can find the entrance when they return. And these results raised another question, and that was, did the wasp respond to the pine cones themselves, or did they respond to the circular arrangement of these pine cones? And to answer this, Tinbergen again performed a little experiment in which he this time arranged the pine cones when the wasp had left the burrow. He arranged the pine cones in a triangle, and he arranged just next to the nest a circle of stones. And when the wasp returned, it was actually searching in the center of the stone circle for its nest entrance. And that indicates that the wasp was responding to the arrangement of the landmarks rather than the landmark itself. So to summarize these experiments, and also to give a definition of piloting, animals remember the location of a goal relative to two or more landmarks around it. And when they approach these landmarks, they do this from a single compass direction. So that means that the animal doesn't have to memorize the whole template, the whole arrangement of landmarks in relation to each other, because when it just flies from one direction always towards its goal, then it just needs to memorize two landmarks relative to each other and to the goal. The next navigational strategy that I want to introduce you is called path integration or depth reckoning. This is often used by insects, for example, foraging ants, that when they go out and search for food, they keep track of the distance that they travel in, and they also keep track of the direction in which they travel in. And out of these two measures, they compute a net vector that brings them directly back to their nest location. This method is only good for short distances and has been tested in different studies that it accumulates a lot of errors, so it can't be used for very long distance. One study animal that has been examined a lot is the desert ant, Cataglyphus. Here, as I just told you, the ants go out to search for food. They have a search path, and then they found the food source. And on their way out, they have kept record of the distance and then direction that they went out in. And then they are able to compute a vector
that brings them back home in a very straight path. And there are two kinds of information necessary to be able to do this. First of all, the ants need to be able to determine their direction that they went into. They often use the sun or polarized light to do this. I will talk about this in a second. And they need to keep track of the distance that they traveled to be able to compute this vector. And there have been different hypotheses on what kind of cues the animals use to compute this distance. It was, for example, one hypothesis that they use the optic flow around their eyes. So the images that pass their eyes give them an idea of how far they traveled. A different hypothesis was that they count their steps and that this allows them to measure the distance. And in a very fascinating experiment, scientists have found that it is indeed the steps that the ants count to determine the distance that they travel. And to discover this, the scientists have captured the ants once they reach the feeder, once they have finished their outbound trip. And then they've manipulated the legs of these ants. They have either shortened the legs of the ants so that they had to return with shorter legs that were these kind of stumps, or they glued little stilts to the legs of the ants so that they made the legs longer, or they let them return on their normal legs. And when the ants return on their homebound trip, you can see where the ant starts to search for its nest entrance. And this gives an idea of what the ant is keeping track on and where it expects its nest. And those ants that were on stilts had a much shorter homebound run. They expected the entrance of the nest earlier because they had covered the normal amount of steps that they had calculated, but the legs, of course, were shorter so that they didn't exactly cover the same distance. Ants with normal legs expected the nest entrance just right at the 10 meters where the nest entrance in fact was. And those ants on stilts overshoot their homebound run. So they also performed the same number of steps, but because their legs were slightly longer, they walked further and expected their nest at a different location. Another way by which animals can navigate is by following a certain compass direction. That means an animal needs to establish a reference direction, for example, geographic north, and then it needs to be able to orient itself in relation to this. Another way by which animals can navigate is by simply following a compass direction. That means an animal follows a certain heading towards a goal or a landmark, and this often happens during the homing phase of its long distance migration and navigation. To be able to do this, animals usually need to be able to determine, for example, geographic north using the sun or the magnetic field, and then they can orient themselves in their desired direction in relation to this reference compass direction. The simplest compass orientation mechanism, and also the first compass orientation mechanism that was described and discovered, is the sun compass. Here, an animal can determine its compass direction by using the position of the sun in the sky, and it can do this regardless of the time of the day or the season. To be able to do this, young animals must observe and learn the path of the sun and must link the sun's horizontal position in the sky to their own circadian clock. And once they can do this, animals can adapt their compass responses throughout the season when the sun changes its movement across the sky. And one animal that is able to do this is the monarch butterfly. I have talked to you before about these long distance journeys from the northern parts of the American continent to Mexico. And observations from a flight simulator have shown that monarchs can orient constantly towards the southwest, and they do this by using visual cues, and they rely in the first place on the horizontal position of the sun in the sky. And these butterflies use the circadian clock to compensate for the changing position of the sun, and that allows them to maintain a fixed flight bearing during their migration. To discover whether animals use a sun compass during navigation, researchers often use an experimental approach that is called a clock shift experiment. This has been done many times on homing pigeons, which also use a sun compass for their navigation. And in these experiments, pigeons or other animals are kept for some time in a light-proof room and exposed to periods of light and darkness that differ from the natural environment. The photoperiod of these animals begins 6 hours before natural sunrise and ends 6 hours before sunset. And that means that the setting of their internal clock is shifted 6 hours fast. And to determine whether monarch butterflies use the sun compass, researchers also performed a clock shift experiment with them. They trained some of these monarchs to fly in an artificial daylight that had been clock shifted by 6 hours. So some of these butterflies would view the sun's position at midday as being at where it should be at 6 a.m. And when they look at the flight direction of these butterflies that are shown here in this circular diagram, so each point is the direction in which an individual flies, and the average is the arrow is the average flight direction of all tested individuals. And here you see that this is a southward direction, and the control group that hasn't been clock shifted migrates in a normal southward direction. But those butterflies that have been clock shifted 6 hours fast flew at 90 degrees to the direction they should have been flying in. Here you see that those individuals rather flew north than south. And these clear shifts in the direction confirms that the butterflies use a time-compensated sun compass. Many migrating animals also travel at night, and these animals also need to be able to hold their course when traveling in the dark. Night traveling species can benefit from encountering, for example, fewer predators, or the drop in temperature at night may help them to avoid heat exhaustion when they cross warmer regions. The nocturnal navigational strategy of birds may be based on identifying the center of rotation of the starry sky. This orientation does not require any time compensation, and the rotation center of the starry sky indicates a geographic north. And the first species that was found to use this navigational strategy was a small passerine, the indigo bunting. And to test this, scientists caught during autumn migration wild birds and moved them into a planetarium. And there they confined them in a small funnel, and the movements within the funnel indicated to the scientists in which direction these birds wanted to go. Under natural conditions, the birds had a very nice southerly direction. And then they started to remove certain star constellations. And only when they removed star constellations around the polar star, so around the center of rotation, the birds started to behave in a disoriented way. Other species use possibly different features of the night sky. Seals, for example, have also been moved into a floating planetarium, and they have also been tested on which cues of the sky they respond to. And it has been found that they rather do not respond to the rotation center, but rather to bright stars, individual bright stars in the sky.
Insects, on the other hand, with their compound eyes, cannot use these bright stars because they can't detect them. However, studies have found that they use the Milky Way to orient their movements. The last compass orientation mechanism that I want to introduce to you today is the magnetic compass. It comes from the Earth magnetic field, and this geomagnetic field is shaped as if a big bar magnet were placed at the center of the Earth. This field provides omnipresent information which can help animals to navigate. Animals can, for example, use the direction of the magnetic field, so the polarity, to determine their preferred travel direction. They can also use the inclination angle, that is the angle between the field lines and the surface of the Earth, to determine their direction. And different species use different features of this magnetic field to determine their direction. Birds, fish, amphibians, and also the sea turtles, like the loggerhead turtle I've talked to you about in the beginning, they use the polarity of that field and the inclination as a reference direction. In addition to the directional information, the magnetic field of the Earth also varies predictably across the globe, and the gradients of, for example, field intensity or inclination can possibly allow an animal to determine its position on the Earth. And this brings me to the last navigational strategy that animals can use, and that is true navigation. To achieve this, animals must not only be able to determine a compass direction that they need to follow to reach their goal, but they also need to be able to locate itself in relation to this goal on a map. This so-called map and compass theory is currently the most robust explanation for true animal navigation. And to define true animal navigation, it is the ability of an animal to navigate to its original location after being displaced, or to a specific breeding wintering site without any access to familiar landmarks, without any cues that are emitted by the goal, or any information about the displacement route. And this process of true navigation consists of two steps. The first one is the map step. The animal needs to determine itself with respect to the goal. And it can, as I just mentioned, possibly use the gradient of the magnetic field to do this. And the other one is the compass step. And we have learned about different mechanisms that allow an animal to determine its direction to its goal. And one way to test whether animals are actually true navigators is to conduct a displacement experiment. These experiments are a powerful tool to investigate the navigational mechanisms of an animal. In a displacement experiment, an animal is being transported from one location to a distant location where it's never been before. Another example of a displacement is this experiment on monarch butterflies. It has been conducted to find out whether monarchs are actually true navigators, that means whether they can correct for this displacement, or whether they simply follow a compass bearing to find and then find their wintering grounds in Mexico. And the displacement took place in Canada. Butterflies from the east coast of Canada, from Ontario, were displaced 2,500 kilometers westward to Calgary and then released. And usually butterflies fly from this area, fly along southwesterly direction to find Mexico. And here again, you see a circular diagram that shows the preferred direction of butterflies under normal conditions. And the displaced butterflies also fly along this southwesterly direction. That means the displaced butterflies, in fact, did not correct for the displacement. They did not manage to transfer their
preferred direction towards a southeasterly direction after the displacement, but they kept on going into a southwesterly direction. And that indicates that these butterflies are in fact not true navigators, but that they inherit a compass direction that they follow on their first migration to a southwesterly direction. Now, with this, I'm at the end of this lecture, and I would like to give you a brief summary of the things that we have just talked about today. First, migration is a temporary movement of individuals between two well-separated areas. Migration has an adaptive value because migrants minimize their travel costs while gaining major benefits from their journeys. Migrants have navigational strategies that differ in their complexity. And tracking studies and behavioral experiments are essential when trying to understand the mechanisms and functions of animal migration. So with this, I'm at the end of this lecture. Please feel free to email me if you have any questions. Also use the lecture time slot for a Q&A. Come and we can discuss your questions and ideas. I hope I could excite you a bit about this work and the kind of research that we do. If you're interested, feel free to contact me. I'm always happy to have interns. I have Hebe jobs available sometimes, and also, of course, bachelor or master thesis. And with it, I thank you very much. Bye.